Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, everyone. I'm Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. On Perpetual Chess, I have weekly conversations with the chess world's best players, promoters, and educators about their lives, careers, current projects, and best practices. Perpetual Chess is brought to you through the generosity of its Patreon and PayPal supporters. For more information, go to perpetualchesspod.com. Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We have an outstanding guest this week. He is the three-time U.S. champion. He has written some great chess books. He's a coach as well. Well-known, I think, to most of our listeners. GM Joel Benjamin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Ben. It's good to be here.
So, Joel, you've been someone I've wanted to get on for a long time, of course, because you're a very strong player, and you've also just had a wide variety of experiences in the chess world, ranging from working on the Deep Blue team to being, you know, an active and competing chess grandmaster to the books you've written. And speaking of books, the proximate cause for your joining us this week is you just released Better Thinking, Better Chess, which as we speak is available in Kindle, and Amazon says it will be available in paper form by Christmas. I already read it. I really enjoyed it. So, Joel, what was the impetus for this latest book of yours?
This book really came about from my work as a private teacher, as a team coach, and a lecturer at camp. Because, you know, when I would give the lessons, I always like to get feedback. I like to try to figure out how the players are thinking and approaching a position. And what I came to understand is that a lot of mistakes are made in chess not because of lack of knowledge, but because of flaws in the thinking process. For instance, I found that a lot of my students, say rated around the expert level, would play the first move that popped into their head. Now, it's not like they just played it, you know, within 10 seconds like a beginner, but they'd look at a position, they'd find a good move, and they'd say, oh, okay, I can't find anything wrong with that, I'll just play it. So we'd go over a game, and I'd say, okay, well, why didn't you play this move? And the answer would be, I didn't see it. And I said, well, why didn't you see it? And they'd have to admit, because they didn't look for it. So the bottom line on this book is that it's a strategy book that's not so much content based, you know, like teaching about tactics or pawn structure or anything like that, but how to take what you know and put it all together and think more clearly and efficiently during your games and thus maximize your results.
Okay. Yeah. And I'm certainly guilty of the problems you describe.
I am too.
I generally fit in that rating box. I mean, I'm 21 to 2200, and sometimes And I think I've talked about this before, but when I compete, sometimes I like you say, I miss moves. So you talk about what you think some of the anecdotes are in the book, but do you mind giving a little taste for our listeners of some of your recommendations?
Well, one of the things is that, you know, don't take shortcuts. As I said, you know, don't play the first move that pops into your head. I think the first minute or two of your think is very often the critical stage, is, you know, is to start by noticing your possibilities and not zeroing in on one move too quickly and not noticing other stuff. One thing I talk about is I reference, you know, that the great book from my old friend Charlie Hertan, Forcing Chess Moves. And I say, like, one of the great things about the book is the title. You know, it's just the idea that you start by looking for forcing moves. You know, you look for moves that attack pieces and take pieces and checks and stuff. And so you make sure that you always give at least some attention to those types of moves at the beginning, even if you reject them quickly, just to be aware that they're there, because they can matter more than you notice at first. So that's just a couple of things, you know, that pop up in the book.
And as someone, so you said that you're no stranger to these mistakes yourself, but I would imagine that as such a strong player, you're less familiar than someone like me, and then most of your students, even though your students, I know a lot of, especially those that you teach privately, are strong up and coming players with a lot of potential. So do you notice anything, like, is their progression the same as yours was when you were a young player, or is there something that needs to be ironed out that you didn't deal with yourself?
Well, the thing is that every chess player is different, and this, for me, is the major part of my teaching philosophy. It's very much in contrast to, let's say, the Soviet style of teaching, where the coach just presents material and basically tells the student how terrible they are, that they don't understand anything. But, you know, you have to, you know, like when I take on a new student, the first thing I do is I say, okay, send me, let's say, 30 of your most recent games. And I look at the games and I try to figure out what type of player this is. Because everybody has a different progression. You know, like, my star student, John Burke, who, you know, frankly, doesn't need me anymore, because right. I think he's higher rated than me now. He, you know, like when he was 9 years old, he was amazingly good tactically. And it's not just like 9-year-olds are good tactically, like they see things. It's that he calculated. And a lot of kids don't even calculate. They just don't want to.
Yeah.
So that was never a problem, you know, getting him to calculate, you know, like that. So he was great in that area. But with other students, you know, sometimes they would like to play on feel, and they wouldn't calculate enough, or they make, you know, those sloppy errors. So, so every student is different, and in the book, actually, I present games played by my students, you know, and mistakes that they made, and of course, you know, with the statement that these are really strong players and they make mistakes less often than other young players do, but it just kind of shows the typical things that even strong players have to go through. And of course, there's some of not only my successful games, there are also some mistakes for my games as well.
Yeah, it's funny that you should mention John Michael Burke, because I'm familiar with his name, being that I, you know, follow chess pretty closely, and he's been rising rapidly. But the other day I was trying out Puzzle Rush on chess.com, which, of course, I don't know if you've had a chance to check this out, but
I've been hearing people talk about it.
Yeah, it's quite an addictive little format where tactics are presented, and when you do it, they show the leaderboard in real time. So I was just checking out all the GMs at the top, and John, your student,
really?
Was I mean, it's not an all-time leaderboard that they show at that moment. It's like the real-time leaderboard, but there he was, like, right at the top, speaking of tactical ability. But I also wanted to ask you, so you mentioned that you use a lot of your students' games, which I think is refreshing because you've got a lot of your own games over the years. But also, I mean, you see people's names in the book that I'm not accustomed to seeing in the chess book, especially being, we were talking before we recorded, we both live in New Jersey and have been in New York over the years. So we probably know a lot of the same players. But I was curious, so in terms of selecting the material, how do you go about it? Like, is it from the bottom up or from the top down? Do you see a game and say that needs to be in the book, or do you have a theme and then just have to sort of comb through the memory banks of what illustrates that theme?
It was a little bit of both, and it was kind of like that with my endgame book as well. It's like you see a game and that's okay, yeah, that's an example of a certain type of flawed thinking, and that triggered the book in the first place. And so there are a number of games that really kind of jump out as needing to go in there. And then I would, you know, look around to flesh things out and to try to get also fair representation of the students, because I didn't want to have, you know, show like, you know, 15 mistakes from one student and right. 2 mistakes from the other. So, you know, I tried to be fair in that sense. But, you know, sometimes I have students that are actually, you know, really good in providing games that with sort of instructive mistakes. And sometimes I have students that really aren't so good at that. And it's not necessarily the case that the first type of player is weaker than the other. It's just that some players are steady and some players are, you know, more up and down.
Yeah, for sure. Sorry, we're going to let that noise pass. how long does it take you to write a book like this, Joel?
I don't really remember exactly, but I'll say something like 6 months. I would say that this was, I published 4 books now. This was the hardest one to write because the subject matter is kind of amorphous, you know, like I said, how to think in chess, you know, and because I couldn't call it Think Like a Grandmaster, because that's obviously taken
yeah.
already. you know, it's just a very kind of wide ranging topic, and try to kind of pick out the things about thought that I think are most important and useful for the book. So, you know, opposed to, let's say, you know, liquidation into a pawn ending, that's a very specific subject. So I just, you know, that was very easy to research. You know, this one was a bit harder. But also there were certain topics that went in the book because, you know, they were just, you know, particular things that came to me. Like one of the chapters is called Material and Initiative. And like one thing I've noticed over the years is that players, let's say players below the 2300, never sacrifice the exchange. They just don't do it unless
I highlighted that in the book. I found that interesting.
Right, unless it's a mate, or you win back material. You know, like one of my star students, I guess not in the book, but. You know, was in this big competition, and he shows me this game where he's got a fiend-catted bishop, and he pushes up his e-pawn and, you know, attacks something, and the guy takes a pawn, he takes a rook in the corner. So he wins, I'm making air quotes now, he wins the exchange. But then he has these horrible light squares, and he's, like, in danger of getting mated, and he has to do hoops, run through hoops the whole rest of the game. And, you know, he was already, you know, like master level. But, you know, because of lack of experience, he didn't understand. That exchange meant nothing, you know?
Right.
So, you know, some players understand this kind of strategy sooner than others. But that's part of, you know, what that chapter is about. To make people understand that material is not more important than everything else. It's just a feature of a chess position. And that I found that, you know, the players below the master level, you know, like if you would attack a pawn, they would have to defend that pawn. They couldn't think of not defending the pawn or letting you take the pawn. And, you know, like if you look at high level grandmaster chess, and I talk about guys that are really beyond my level, is they just give away pawns right and left.
Right.
You know, they don't think about it.
Yeah.
You know, and some of these pawn sacrifices, I say like, well, that's actually a little bit too deep for me. You know, they just say, well, okay, I just have, you know, my pieces are a little bit better mobilized and I have a little bit of time to do something. And a pawn, it's going to be a long time before that makes a difference. So that was kind of something that I realized, you know, that until you start coaching, you may not realize that, hey, you know, everybody out there doesn't realize, you know, how useful an exchange sacrifice can be. So there's a chapter there has a lot of, you know, types of sacrifices, but also just showing, you know, like how, you know, like how a player gets in trouble because of instinctively defending a pawn when they need to let the pawn go to achieve something else. So that's actually one of my favorite chapters because I think it's probably something that's almost never been explored in the literature.
Yeah, I mean, the only example I can think of is Jonathan Rowson in Seven Deadly Chess Sins talks about materialism as one of the sins. And, you know, that put that on my radar when I read it, but I'm still just as guilty as anyone else. There's sort of, I mean, you spend so much time as a developing chess player trying not to hang stuff that you just get an materialism ingrained. And another, another very instructive strong player is AlphaZero. I mean, I haven't seen a ton of its games, but it's as you say, giving away material left and right for.
Yeah, but nobody understands what AlphaZero is doing. It's actually not very instructive because it's just wins. But you know why it's doing these moves? I just looked at that match that you know that it played against you know that rigged match against Stockfish, and I didn't understand anything it was doing.
I have to follow up on you're calling it a rigged match. So what didn't you like about the format?
Well, because it wasn't like AlphaZero challenged Stockfish and the owners of Stockfish put their program forward. You know, they just grabbed a commercial version of an available version of Stockfish and decided what the conditions of the match were going to be. So it was somewhat rigged. It's not to say that AlphaZero isn't capable of beating Stockfish, but you know, it just some of the parameters of the match were arbitrary.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and just to clarify, obviously, I'm not saying I can understand everything that AlphaZero does, but I do feel like with the fact that it's making so many sacrifices, at least lends credence to the point that that players below the 2300 level are probably clinging to their material a little too tightly.
Yeah, but AlphaZero is doing it because it can see to the end of the game, whereas Masters don't see to the end of the game. They just understand that they don't have to. And that's what the weaker players can't do. They feel like they say, "Yeah, I saw I could sack the exchange, but I didn't know it was going to happen." And that's their reason for rejecting it. They just, you know, it didn't lead to anything, so they just don't do it. But I want to jump in here with a point because you brought up that book by Rowson, and one of my editors asked me about a bibliography for the book, and there isn't one because I just didn't use other sources. I didn't use other sources because I thought that if I actually tried to educate myself and read up on other people, then I'd start to say I'd be too much influenced by it and the book would be too derivative. So this book really comes out of my own ideas and experiences, which is not to say that they're 100% original ideas. Of course, you know, other strong players and thinkers have come up with these ideas as well. And maybe presented them a slightly different way. So I don't want anybody to say, oh, he just copied that from some. I certainly did copy it from anybody because I did not really read other books. And I don't say that as a virtue. I'd say that probably I should I should read more of the available material out there. But once I had the idea to write the book, I really didn't want to be influenced by other people. But what I think about this book, much like the liquidation book, is that even though, you know, parts of it are you would say like, oh, well, there was a book about that, there's a book about that. But I feel like the totality of the book, all these different subjects have not been presented together in a book before. And, you know, I could be wrong about that, but I don't think that that type of presentation has come before.
Thanks for the clarification. Yeah, and I think that anyone who reads this book will see the material. The positions, as I mentioned before, are so fresh that it's presented in a different way than any chess book I've read, and I really benefited from it and suffer from a lot of the afflictions mentioned in it. So I wanted to quickly touch on your other books, Joel. So you said four books. Does that count unorthodox openings?
Yes.
Okay, because I go way back. I
wrote that book. I mean, it was back in the 80s, and it was, I wrote that book with Eric Schiller, and who unfortunately recently passed away. It's a terrible shame. One of the reasons why Eric was so popular as a co-author is because it was 1980s. He had desktop publishing. Mm-hmm. You know, people today can't really picture how hard it was to write a book back in the 1980s when people were just starting to get computers that had, word processing. And there was no internet. You know, we didn't have the same tools. So, he had the tools that made it, a lot easier to write a book. But I have to say, I wrote that book. I think I wrote it over 2 years. I started writing it at 21 and finished it at 23. And I was like a different person. I thought about chess completely differently. And I was extremely dogmatic, because I would look at an opening and say like, okay, now I'm going to refute it. And, remember, there's no engines. Nobody has an engine back then. I'm just going to analyze and refute the Chigorin's defense. And of course it was ridiculous. And the great irony of it is that after writing that book, which was basically, what to do if your opponent throws some junk at you, I actually became very well known for playing unorthodox openings because I started to look at chess in a different way.
Yeah. Well, I think, as you say, it's certainly views have changed since then. But I loved the book when it came out. As you may remember, I grew up and went to the same school as Greg Shahadi, and we loved that book. We would laugh at openings like the cabbage.
it was an entertaining book, but yeah. But all in all, I would say it probably was my fourth best book.
Yeah, and just American Grandmaster, I'd like to discuss later. I love that book, and you mentioned before we were recording, you've got an updated version of Liquidation on the Chessboard coming out as well.
Right, I have put the finishing touches on that and sent that off to the publishers. I don't know exactly what they're calling it. Maybe a new and improved version. It's got all of the material from the first book, but it's got more than 50 new positions, and further exploration of endgame themes. So, certainly collectors are definitely going to want to have. To have this edition, but if you haven't, if you didn't buy the first one, this is a great opportunity because this is the best. This will be the best liquidation, best liquidation out yet.
And I guess we can look for it in a few months.
Yeah, I think that will be out in the spring sometime. Okay.
Cool. Looking forward to it. Well, Joel, we could talk about your books all day, but if you don't mind, I want to take a quick break and then discuss the World Championship, of course.
Sure.
I'm excited to announce that this week's episode of Perpetual Chess is brought to you in part by Chessable. If you're a regular listener to Perpetual Chess, you probably heard me and our esteemed guests extol the virtues of Chessable even when they were not our sponsors. Chessable uses learning science to help you improve your chess as efficiently as possible. It's a great way to remember more ideas faster, even for a middle-aged dad like me. What's more, they're an open platform where anyone can publish their courses. I'm talking to you, chess teachers and coaches. And they've paid out hundreds of thousands of dollars in commissions to their partner authors. They have big plans for 2019. So if you're a student, author, or coach, be sure to check out Chessable.com. So, Joel, I forgot to mention in the introduction that you do a show for ICC where you go over games and do banter blitz and all that sort of thing. And I know that you did a recap of some of the World Championship already. But for those that didn't catch it or for any new impressions you formed, could you tell us sort of what the first thing that when you reflect back on this match in a couple years, you'll think about?
Well, the match, in a lot of ways, the match went as I predicted. I said all along that Caruana was not inferior in classical chess to Carlsen. He'd been playing fantastically all year in a lot of pressure situations, and Carlsen had really been more or less kind of waiting for this match to happen. And you know, people out there don't realize it's not that easy to just turn on your game like a switch. Even the best players in the world, I could say for me that, you know, when I start winning a couple games in the tournament, then I play with a lot more confidence and I get on a roll. And Carlsen, he could never get on the roll in the match. You know, from game one, he had a winning position. He achieved a winning position pretty early, and he did nothing with it. He not only didn't win it, it was just a matter of, it's not like he miscalculated something or made a mistake. It's that he just kind of couldn't pull the trigger. He just couldn't do what he needed to do to finish Fabiano off. And that really set the tone, is that he never played with confidence. And when he had the white pieces, he was able to achieve nothing whatsoever. The only momentum in the match that was generated at all was when Fabiano had white. And sometimes he generated negative momentum, you know, that he actually got himself into trouble. But, the most interesting games came when Fabiano was white. So, you know, there were a couple of missed opportunities. There was that really, really difficult win to find in that crazy ending with the extra piece, which is it's an explainable. It's not really an alpha zero kind of thing. It is explainable why Bishop H4 wins, but it's very, very hard to see that in a game when you got 10 minutes, unless you know you have a winning move.
Right at that moment,
then you can spend 8 minutes looking for it, and he would find it. He would figure it out if he knew to look for it. That's one of the things about the book, is you know, the book I just wrote is knowing when to look, knowing when to take your time and look for these things. But there was nothing there was no signal to look for that. So, you know, that was a great opportunity. I would say practically the biggest opportunity was in that first Svechnikov game when he had the big advantage and he hesitated with H3. And so that was the problem, is that he really kind of, he had the, you know, like they would say in soccer, he had the run of play in the 12 games, but he didn't score a win. And the other part of the match, which I predicted was, everybody predicted, was that Fabiano would have a difficult time in fast chess. And unfortunately, that was true. And so for me, it just all kind of leaves a little bit of a bad taste, you know, that you had this really tense, extremely even match, and then you shift to a different type of chess entirely, and then it becomes a rout. It just didn't seem right to me.
Yeah, although I do feel like the chess world generally is still sort of casting about for the solution, because it's true that it's a different format, and Magnus clearly has an advantage in this format as it happens, but in the past, the format of tie goes to the champion isn't perfect either, so it's not entirely clear to me what should be done. Do you have any fresh ideas?
Well, it isn't perfect, but I think from a chess point of view, it's better. The only thing is that, you know, if you're talking about a casual fan or the general public who maybe never, you know they know how to play chess, let's say, but they never really thought about it before. I think, you know, people would say, like, yeah, this is great because, you know, it comes down to this tiebreak. They got tremendous TV ratings in Norway. Everybody loved it. It was very entertaining. But, oh, my God, it's just horrible. As a chess player, I just think it's horrible. So I think, you know, they really should they should have longer matches. And the challenger, okay, so there's a little bit more on the challenger, but it was really the same thing here because, you know, realistically, Fabiano had to win the game and had to win the match in 12 games. So why not make it a longer match, and the tie goes to the champion? I think what you could even have is let's say a certain length of the match, like 12 or 16 games, and then go to I would go to sudden death tiebreak, but in classical games, and play let's say four classical games, and at the end of four games, if still nobody has won, then the match is over and you give it to the champion. The only problem with that, I can see that it's never going to happen, is because organizationally it's a mess, because there's such a great gap in the possible length of time of the match. So it would never happen. But I think from a competitive point of view, it would be great.
Yeah, and two other things I'd like to highlight, just that I've heard people mention that I think would be positive changes, is I do think it's a little too many rest days. I mean, us weekend warriors, we have to play six games in 3 days or whatever it is. Obviously, it doesn't need to be that extreme, but I think maybe 3 days on, 1 day off.
Yeah, for a 12-game match, it's not very long. It's kind of funny because I was thinking about the logistics, you know, that if you had more games, you know, the match, you know, could take, you know, a month and a half. So there would be an argument that, well, if you cut down the rest days a little bit, then it wouldn't be so long. On the other hand, you'd say that if it's a longer match, the guys are going to get more tired. But I'd still rather see them play classical games when they're tired than playing rapid chess when they're slightly more healthy and fit. If they get tired, then you have kind of the effects that you have of the fast games, and that they might make more mistakes. But that seems like it's kind of more a part of the standard classical format than what they did, which just feels kind of arbitrary. So I would just rather see them not have the rapid playoff. But just from historical a point of view, it's kind of interesting when you go back in time. If you go back to, let's say, some of the candidates matches from the 80s. Now, this is back before they had digital clocks even, and certainly no increment, but there was never even a thought of deciding these things by any kind of fast chess. You know, they had candidates matches that were ultimately decided by a roulette spin of the roulette wheel. You know, just right. By chance, that was better than, let's say, an Armageddon game, you know?
It's yeah.
Just, I mean, I think even Armageddon is better than flipping a coin, but it's just only, you know, now it's like, yeah, fast chess, it's great. I guess mainly because people are literally watching the games.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I do have to admit, I like the fast chess. As a sports fan, to me, it's intuitive, because like in football and basketball, American football, that is, after the regulation time, they speed it up and just keep going. So, but I get it. I get why the classicists, don't want the format changed. And I get that it's a different skill set. But I have to confess, I come down a little more on the side of my friend Greg Shahadi on this one. But
I have to just jump in and say that, you know, I've read many things that Greg has written, and he is a fountain of ideas, but I disagree with almost everything that he writes.
Yeah.
Most emphatically about the part about the one he wrote about how, oh, you know, getting old doesn't mean that you can't be just as good as chess. You know, like I'm 38 years old and I'm in the best shape of my life. Yeah. But you don't have children.
Amen. I agree with that one.
That's what he doesn't understand. It's that your life changes. It's not just that you get older.
Yeah. You know Donnie Ariel. Yes. I hope I'm not not airing something that was supposed to be off the record. But Donnie at some point said he wanted Greg to have kids so that it would wipe the smile off his face.
Yeah,
I totally get it. Yeah, Greg has a special set of circumstances. I mean, great guy, God bless him. But yeah,
once upon a time, I had an easy life like that. I was living in my Manhattan apartment, and I could wake up at 10 o'clock every day if I wanted to. But people's lives change.
Yeah, and kids overall are a blessing, but they don't help your chess skill, that's for sure.
Right.
Do your kids play any chess, Joel?
My son plays a little bit. Actually, he's become a little bit of a fan, so that now, you know, sometimes I go to tournaments, I bring a chessboard and I get all the players to sign it, you know, because he loves that kind of thing. That really started from the charity chess event when mm-hmm. he met Fabiano, and he got Fabiano to, you know, Fabiano's signature, and he took a picture with him. So so he likes chess, and he watches my shows sometimes, but he has not been in a USCF tournament, and he's a little bit hesitant about it, you know, because he's got big shoes to fill. You know, I tell him over and over again, I don't expect you to be as good as me. I really, it's not important. I just want you to enjoy the game. But, you know, I don't know how far he's gonna take it. And my daughter at this point has expressed zero interest in chess.
And how old are your kids?
My son is 10, and my daughter will be imminently turning 8.
Okay. Yeah, it seems like players of your level, it's more common than not that the kids, as you allude to, feel like they might have big shoes to fill.
Well, it's a historical fact that there has never been a grandmaster whose child became a grandmaster. That's never happened.
That's a really good point.
You've had, if you look at sports, you've seen, you know, children of great players, of Hall of Famers, you know, have tremendous professional careers. But it hasn't really happened in chess.
Yeah, I'm racking my brain trying to think if there's anyone on the horizon, and no one jumps to mind. But yeah, that's interesting. So Joel, you've written a lot about sort of, you touch on a lot of your games in your books, and especially in American Grandmaster, you sort of write in a very personal way about them. But I'm endeavoring to talk more about what guests' favorite games are. And I know you highlighted a few in the things that you've written, but do you have one game above all that comes to mind? Putting you on the spot.
It's hard. Yeah, I might give you more than one.
That works.
One of my all-time favorite games was a win I had over over Yasser Seirawan in the U.S. Junior Championship in 1980. And one of the reasons I love this game is because I played it when I was 16 years old, and I don't know if I've ever played a better game after that, you know, with all that I learned since. So I would say that, you know, judging on a curve, you know, that was really, that could be said to be my best game. My definitely, you know, like when it comes to favorite moves, there's a game in the New York Open I played when I made this great bishop sacrifice, very unlikely bishop sacrifice to open up my opponent's king and get my queen into the game and get a winning counterattack.
What game was that?
It was against Abramovich, and basically the game only exists, is only known to man because I sent it to the combination section of the informant at the time. So I only, the moves only exist from the, you know, from the point where the combination starts. The first 40 moves of the game are not in any database, and I don't personally have them.
Oh, funny. Was that in any of your books, that combination?
Yeah, it's in all of them. it's in American Grandmaster, and it's in Better Thinking, Better Chess. I mean, that is the one thing that if you are a Joel Benjamin fan and and you get my books, that there has been a little bit of repetition there. First in American Grandmaster presenting the games as games, but here they're presented in a thematic way. And right. And I just want to give you one more game. I'd say the best game that I was involved in, not necessarily the best game that I played, was a game that I lost to Lajos Portis in the 1987 Interzonal, because it was really a great up-and-down game with crazy complications, where his king, I was black, and his king actually marched all the way to g6, and I wasn't able to surround it successfully. But that was, I thought, the best game that I was involved in.
Okay, so I'm going to link to those games in the show description just as an aside for listeners. I haven't been talking about games too much because obviously this is an audio-only format, so to me, it's not the most natural fit, but you guys give me a shout and let me know if you want to hear more of that from guests or less of that, and I'm happy to discuss it or not discuss it. But in any event, I look forward to reviewing those games in more detail. I mean, having been going through your books recently, I remember the Sarawan game, and it's quite nice. And speaking of your playing, so Joel, you still manage to play, I think you said, about four times a year.
Hold on, I should jump in and say that now that I remember, that Sarawan game was actually played in 1979, and I was 15. I don't know how I got that wrong, but it was 79 that the game.
Well, I'm amazed how many details you remember generally from these games. I mean, it's quite impressive, and it's very, you know, I like I said before, I want to get to American Grandmaster, but the memories are so vivid that it's pretty cool to relive. But first, let's talk about more recent ones. So you were in St. Louis, I think it was about a month ago, playing in an invitational. How did that go?
Well, I was kind of surprised to get an invitation because, you know, old people usually, tournaments usually don't pay much attention to the older players. You know, they want to have the hot young players, and also there are so many grandmasters that are easily accessible to, you know, to St. Louis because there's so many college programs out there. But I had, I had approached them about senior chess, and they thought like, oh yeah, we should have some of these guys out here. So hopefully I'm the first and not the last, and they'll be inviting, you know, some of my colleagues out to play in these tournaments. But I thought that it was really kind of interesting experiment. I was playing in a tournament. It was the Winter Classic B, and they have on a regular basis, they have these invitational tournaments, these grandmaster events, and they usually have two sections. The top section is sort of like 2,600 players, and the second section is basically 2,500 players. And so I played in the B group, and a lot of the field were players that were one-third my age. So, you know, I mean, talk about an age gap. I mean, that was crazy. But it was very interesting for me to play against a new generation. And in fact, a lot of the players in the tournament, I didn't even really know what they looked like because I have been to so few open tournaments in the last few years. I don't even know what people look like. I just see names, you know, when I do my show. So it was kind of interesting, the competition. But, I didn't do all that well because I had too many, as the commentator Jesse Cry put it, senior moments. And I just find that, you know, that my blundering is really bad these days. And I just gave away a few games. The games that I lost three games in the tournament, they were just terrible. But also there was one game I drew where I had a completely winning position, you know, one that I really would normally win in my sleep. And I drew against Michaleski, which ended up helping him go on to tie for first. So I finished minus one in the tournament, and this, like all tournaments, give me mixed signals because I look at the games and I say like, okay, Joel, you still got it. You know, your mind is not feeble. You still understand the game. You're still generating good moves. You're showing understanding. But then there are the senior moments. I notice that, you know, that I ruin too many games, that I don't finish like I used to. And so, you know, I don't know what to do. You know, does it mean I need to play more, or does it mean that I need to concentrate on writing books?
That's interesting that you mentioned that. I mean, I'm younger than you and I'm way weaker than you, but I sort of struggled with the same issue in a recent tournament. Like, for my level, most of my moves were pretty good, but then there were just a few stinkers. So,
a lot of it is how often you play. And because I play very infrequently, it's harder for me to be in good form. I really have to play myself into form. You know, like for instance, in the earlier in the year, in the summertime, I played in the World Senior Team Championship, and you know, that tournament, in the first round, I beat a low-rated player. Then my second game, I drew against a 2100. I was still a little bit sleepy from the jet lag. And then I lost my third game to John M. So it's like a really very, very poor start. But then I, I won a game, you know, then I started winning games, and I ended up beating two grandmasters and having a good result in the end. But like every game I won, I just felt so much better. And by the time that I played Yusupov, I was on a three-game winning streak, and I actually went into that game very confident, and I won that game as well. So like I said, when you don't play, a lot of the problem for older players is that if you don't play frequently, then it's just much, much harder to turn it on.
Yeah, so you don't feel like you have the secret in terms of what the prescription would be other than just play more, which is not always feasible.
It's not feasible. Yeah, it's just, you know, I mean, I got kids, I got a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's you know, it's and there are, you know, there are guys my age that play more often, and they, you know, generally find a better form and able to play up to their expectations. I see my FIDE rating is now a lot closer to 2,500 than it is to 2,600.
Mm-hmm.
And I look at the players that I play against and guys out there, what their ratings are. And, you know, like a 2,650 player to me is not 130 points stronger than me.
Right. Just,
you know, because I used to beat guys like that. So, you know, I feel like I'm really underrated, but I don't know if I'm genuinely underrated when I go into a tournament and I haven't played for 3 months, you know, because I don't really perform at the level that, you know, that my understanding is at now.
Yeah. And at this stage of your career, with all that you've accomplished, how much does it bother you? Like how quickly do you forget it when you get back home?
It bothers me, but I can accept it because I just understand that that's how my life is now, and it's very, very, very rich in other ways. But I do have this vision that, you know, when my kids are a little bit older and more independent, that, you know, I'm going to give it a shot. And I also would like to be active on the senior circuit. But, you know, right now the biggest problem is that there just isn't a lot of money in senior chess, and I can't afford to go out to the senior championship and, you know, spend all that money on travel and hotel, and take, you know, time off and not help the family, not make money in other ways. I just can't do it.
Yeah, that's an expensive hobby.
So this, yeah, it's just there's just some impediments for me to you know, get back into chess and do things the way I'd want to.
Yeah, well, I want to get to the senior tournament in Dortmund, which I think will also dovetail into your American Grandmaster book that I've teased a few times. But one last question about the Winter Classic. I saw that Alexei Dreev in the A section kind of put on a clinic. And
No. That was not the one I was in.
Oh, okay. Was that the one before it?
He was in the fall. And, of course,
okay.
He's a guy that's roughly from my generation. He's actually a little bit younger than me. He is a senior, but he's a little younger than me. But yeah, so that's the thing. But the thing is that Dreev still plays.
He still plays.
And that makes it a lot easier for him to keep up his level. But yeah, and I talked about that result on my show, and I said, you know, as always, you know, this is what you say when people tell you there's no counterplay for old men.
Right. Yeah, that's a good line.
Yeah.
Okay, so getting back to Dortmund, so you went to this U.S. team senior championship, and it was like you were getting the band back together, Shabalov and Yermo and Sergei Kudrin and Jan Elvis, all there with you. So you talked a little about the chess, but what was the overall experience like?
Well, I mean, really, you know, that getting the band back together is a major impetus for wanting to go. And that's why... Well, I mean, I always felt that Olympiads in general were the best tournaments, the most satisfying. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of the guys, you know, didn't or couldn't or wouldn't, whatever, go to the tournament. Like, we couldn't convince Larry Christensen to go. And Greg Kajdanov had a prior commitment he couldn't get out of. And
what's Larry Christensen up to, if I may interject?
I think he just teaches a lot. Unfortunately, he doesn't like to go anywhere. Mm-hmm. And we can't seem to get travel because, I mean, if I were him, I would be going to tournaments all the time because he and Natasha don't have any kids. And I'm sure their financial situation is a lot more settled than ours. So I would be traveling if I were him. But he didn't. Maybe he will do this in the future. But he didn't go. But still, we had Yermo and Shaba, and I actually didn't play in that many team events with Shaba, but I played a lot with Yermo, and those are great experiences. You know, you feel like you play those games. You feel like you're going down in the trenches, you know, with your mates, and
right.
And the games feel a bit more meaningful. But it was really a great experience. I have to give all credit to Alex and Alex, because they just planned out everything. You know, like they rented a car, which they brought over from the West, and the games were at 9:30 in the morning, I guess, because we're old people. You know, I mean, I have kids, so I can get up in the morning now.
Right.
So we were done basically by lunchtime. We had the whole day. So we'd get in the car and we'd go somewhere. We'd have nice meals. Sometimes we have a nice lunch or a nice dinner. We'd do some sightseeing. It was a tremendously relaxing time. It was just really, really fun. And that helped a lot. You know, we were very relaxed, even though in some sense there was a lot of pressure on us, because, you know, we were able to get USCF funding for the tournament. I mean, not a huge amount. It was enough to cover our expenses. But okay, that made it worthwhile if we could go and not lose money.
Yeah.
You know, we were ready to go. And, you know, we felt that, you know, to have any chance of U.S. teams going in the future, we had to bring home the gold medal. So we were very relieved to be able to do that in the end.
Yeah. And just want to echo that it's great that U.S. Chess supported that sort of thing. And I'm certainly in favor of, you know, players of your stature and experience getting to represent the country in events like that. And of course, I would have liked to have been a fly on the wall, I'm sure, some of the misadventures you guys had, whatever you were doing with the meals in between rounds.
Well, you know, it's not a lot of misadventures these days, you know, because we're old people. you know, for instance, our youngest player on the team, Al Shabalov, who I was referring to as barely legal, because he was only 50.
Right.
Although he turned 51 later in the year. But he's a grandpa.
Oh, really?
He's a grandfather. Yes. Yes. So, you know, put that in perspective.
That's funny.
Yeah.
So do you have any tournaments coming up?
I don't have any tournaments coming up to play in. I have tournaments coming up to coach, and you know, it's a kind of a busy schedule. I'm going to Orlando with Columbia Grammar, my, you know, longtime team that I've coached, and you know, we both go back to those days.
Yes.
You know, I guess probably the cities and states after that. So I'll be doing a lot of that. And of course, you know, when I go places, I'm going to be trying to get people to buy my new book, which I really think it's a good book, a very good book. I'm very, very, very pleased with how it, you know, came out. There's always times when I think I could have done something maybe a little bit better, but I think it's a good book. I think it's a new kind of book. And I think that people will be pleased with it, that they'll feel that they're going to learn something from it.
Yeah, I agree. And it can benefit a wide range of ratings. I mean, certainly at my level, there's tons I can learn from it. And I think that it's not so inaccessible that someone, you know, I would say, what do you think, 1600 on up or something like that?
Yeah, you know, people ask me that question. And I'd say, let's say if you're 1200, you'll a lot of the concepts will be very useful. For instance, this one thing I did something along the lines of that I did in liquidation is I have a little chapter where I just give advice. You know, I give like 40 pieces of advice for thinking.
Yeah, it's a nice finish. Yeah.
And so like, you know, even if you're 1200 player, just reading that section, you'll benefit from it. Most of the chess will be over your head, right? So yeah, I would say that you know, for you know, a stronger player will you know, profit more because they'll be able to follow the harder chess. But yeah, I think 1600 would benefit, and I'd say you know, for players like 2000, 2100 will really benefit tremendously, especially because they're very similar to the category in which you know, some of my students represented in the book are. So they can really really speak to them, you know, that experience in chess.
Yeah, yeah, that was definitely, I was nodding my head a lot in reading it, for sure. So Joel, one other topic I would be remiss if I didn't discuss. I mentioned that Greg Shahady and I were big fans of Unorthodox Opening way back in the day, but the Shahadis also had a subscription to Chess Chow. And there was nothing more exciting than when a new issue came. So, for our younger listeners, why don't you just spend a couple minutes just talking about, I mean, I know you go into this in American Grandmaster, but telling the story briefly of Chess Chow.
Well, Chess Chow came about at the beginning of the 90s. I had just moved into Manhattan, and I was sharing a gigantic apartment with international master Mark Ginsburg, who's an old friend of mine. And he also he actually worked in computers, so he was very savvy and you know, understood something about desktop publishing. So we said, hey, let's put out a funny chess magazine, and we, you know, eventually, you know, hit upon Chess Chow, Feed Your Mind. And so we put out this magazine, which was a strange combination of things. It was certainly humor, it was some instructive chess. We leaned on our buddies to provide us content, which we almost never paid them for because we had no money. But, you know, they sort of did a lot of stuff as a favor. Like my good buddy Michael Wilder would write his agony column, which was absolutely hysterical. But I would say one thing about the magazine. It was a very funny magazine. But I look back on it now and I just see, like, oh, I took all kinds of shots at people who were not my friends, you know,
right, yeah.
The people who were my friends, you know, and wrote for me and stuff, you know, they were, but I look back on it now and I actually cringe a little bit about it because, you know, now that I'm older and wiser, I would, you know, take a different tone with that and, you know, not try to embarrass people so much. So it really was, you know, from a different time of my life, you know, when I was, you know, I was in my late 20s then, and I would do things a little bit differently. But the magazines are very entertaining.
Yeah, they're very funny, and there's just nothing like it. I mean, so for listeners, I would describe it. It's obviously, as Joel said, it's a satirical magazine for chess, but I've never seen anything resembling it. It was very funny, and there was chess content too. I mean, obviously, with written by players so strong, you could learn some chess in between the chuckles.
And there was, and, you know, sometimes we'd have, you know, theoretical articles, and they were pretty pretty hard hitting. But of course, this is still time before chess engines were particularly useful. So it was all just, you know, analysis from, you know, blood, sweat, and tears.
And do you have a stack of them sitting somewhere, or are they all?
Yes. Yes, I do.
That's funny.
Because, you know, we didn't sell that many of them, although there are some issues that are almost non-existent that I have very few copies. But basically, they were sitting in my parents' house for a long time, and I eventually cleaned out what I could. So, yeah, the magazine still exists in printed form. Unfortunately, it doesn't exist on the computer because those files were lost.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, to do something with it, we'd have to scan the material back in. You know, Mark and I talked about it, but we never actually acted on it. And, you know, part of me, remember, you know, sees the cringe factor.
Right. Yeah.
So I don't know how much I, you know, want to proceed with it. But
yeah, maybe you could pick the highlights, but then it's like more work. So
yeah,
totally understandable. All right. So Joel, I want to finish with American Grandmaster, which I have to say to listeners, it's the most it's probably the most in the spirit of this podcast book I've ever read. Somehow it had escaped my attention until preparing for this interview. But I mean, it's a great combination of, yes, there are games in it, and yes, you can learn chess from it, but just so many stories. So I highlighted a few, and you're welcome to tell stories that are in the book or other stories from the travel, from your travels. But here are a few that were my personal favorites. Describing Kasparov having his own toilet at the Olympiad, I enjoyed.
Which we were prepared to break into.
Yeah, so could you tell listeners what that experience was like, and we can reflect on how conditions have improved at least a little bit for elite players like yourself?
Well, I haven't been to a lot of these team tournaments for a while. I've gone to a lot of the junior events, but not being a player, I didn't really have to see what the facilities were like. But, remember that, a lot of these places are what you might call third world countries. And, sometimes the bathrooms have what we commonly call Turkish toilets. And, with my upbringing, I don't think I could use one of those. But very often when you get 1,000, 2,000 people together, there's often going to be a lot of germs spreading around, and people get sick and stuff. And if you've got diarrhea and not the best toilet facilities, then you run into problems.
Yeah. So this was the 96 Olympiad in Armenia, right?
Yeah, which was otherwise a really fun event, even though there was almost like a coup that was clamping down on it. So there was a lot of police presence. So it's a little bit weird, but it was a fun tournament.
Okay. Another story I highlighted was Larry Christensen and Ivan Sokolov racing around a lake.
That was from the Blair Olympiad. Yeah, Larry realized his only chance was to cheat. So there was some kind of hidden bicycle that he was supposed to use, but I think the handoff didn't quite work out. So he wasn't able.
And was there a bet on this race, or was it just?
There was a bet. Yeah, I don't remember the parameters of it. Yeah. But,
and speaking of betting, I mean, you mentioned one of the world juniors where Kasparov was a young phenom, but not world champion yet, him taking on all comers in Blitz, and you playing him yourself?
Yes, and he would give me he gave me 5-3, which I guess was kind of an honor, because my second for the event was Michael Wilder, and he got 5-2. He was treated with less respect, but that was the first opportunity I had to play Kasparov. Unfortunately, I didn't get to play him in the real tournament because I just played so badly I didn't get paired with him. I mean, he played almost everybody in the upper half of the cross table, but not me. So I was happy to play with him. And I have to say that the young Kasparov, without a lot of entourage back then, he was a really nice, friendly guy. And he was, I had that experience with him until 1996, and then things changed after that.
Yeah. So 1996, of course, you're referring to your work on Deep Blue, which you also discuss in great detail.
Well, it was really 97 that things went wrong in the second match. But let's put it this way. He's not a good loser.
Yeah.
When he loses, he finds other reasons for it.
Yeah, I don't think we're shocking many listeners with that revelation. But yeah, I mean, it's well detailed, and he's been reticent. I mean, he's been I don't know the right word, but he's walked back some of the things he said in his brasher years.
Because there's no coherent theory that he has.
Yeah,
so he can't really do much with it.
Yeah, and in this day and age, having to argue about why a computer beat a person in chess, it's not an argument.
Right. Well, when you say there's no way that Deep Blue, this computer Deep Blue, would not take those two pawns that it could take, and that you sit at your laptop and you turn on your commercial engine, and within a few seconds it sees not to take the pawn. So it's future events proved that computers could have a higher, in air quotes, level of understanding. It's just that we weren't used to it then. But then, of course, you know, Deep Blue for its time was just a whole different animal.
Yeah, yeah, it was so revolutionary at the time. And so what's your, you mentioned before we were recording again that you're not like particularly tech savvy, but how good are you with engines in terms of your own work for your students and on your chess when you get a chance to do it?
Well, the thing is that I work with engines. I spend a lot of time on engines, and I don't really call that tech, but from my point of view. But I lean on them quite heavily because it's just the fact, you know, the fact of the matter that when you generate any kind of content in chess, it has to be at least engine checked. Otherwise, you know, people rip it apart, you know, because everybody has an engine. So I have to admit that, you know, like I do my weekly show on ICC.
Okay, thank you.
And I, you know, I pretty much put the engine on right away, you know, because I know I'm going to have to, you know, I'm going to have to. So I save time. But one thing that I do, and I'm glad this came up because I do this in the show, but I also do this a lot in the recent book, is I talk about how to understand and use the information you get from engines. Because you see players all the time, they're watching the World Championship match, and their engine is telling them that a certain move is plus one. And, you know, Fabi plays a move that their engine tells them is plus 0.5. And they say, Fabi blundered.
Right.
And they don't even have the inkling of an idea as to why one move is even supposed to be a half a pawn better than the other. But, you know, the engine doesn't always give you useful information. Sometimes the engine tells you to play a move that if you played the move, you would lose because you'd have no idea what the point of the move is. And so one thing that I talk about, and I even talk about this a little bit in Liquidation, is that, you know, it's whatever the engine says, you have to play moves that you understand, you know, that you can see a move. You can see a move that you think might be a brilliant win, but if you don't really know what the follow-up is going to be and you see another move that you're pretty confident you're going to win if you play that move, that's the right move to play. So, like on my show, it generates a lot of crazy computer variations, and I give a lot of them because they're very entertaining, but I also am quick to say, you know, this is something that's never going to happen. You know, it's just fun, fun to look at, but it's not realistic.
Yeah, I think in a couple of key moments in the Carlsen Caruana match, Sfidler said that very thing, like in real time, where because they, you know, they, I know that you watched some of it as well, and they don't look at the engine themselves, but people are yelling at them in the chat from what they see in the engine.
I'm really glad they don't look at the engines. I have to say that I also looked at a lot of this the commentary from St. Louis, and I wish it was more Yasser without the computer and less Maurice with the computer, because Maurice tends to exaggerate things based on having the computer analysis and makes it seem like certain things are obvious about the position because he's got proof of it from the computer, and they're really not. You know, like if you're watching Sfidler and Grishuk, you'll see that they're often struggling more with the position than Maurice is because they're looking at it in a human way, which is how Carlsen and Caruana are looking at the position. They don't get to use a computer. But I did enjoy watching commentary, and I was watching Sfidler mostly in that crazy end game that Caruana missed a complicated win, and Sfidler was saying like the engine score doesn't really matter unless we see it jumping, because that means that something changed.
Right.
But
that's a good point.
And I talk about this a lot in Liquidation on the Chessboard. Because that book was one of the difficulties of writing that book was that in a lot of positions the engine does not help at all, because it just says this move is plus 2.5 and this move is plus 2.5 and so is this one and this one and this one. So basically, it's just like it's saying, you're winning. And you say, like, well, why am I winning? Yeah, you're just winning. But how do I win it? Oh, right. That I don't know. Because they don't understand the concept of needing to make progress. It's not a computer. That doesn't show up in the evaluation. Fortunately, table bases come into play. I believe that they're now up to 7, although I don't know if the average person has access to 7-piece table bases or not. I know that anybody can check out a 6-piece table base on the internet. And I used 6-piece table bases in liquidation on the chessboard, and they were very, very helpful. And I tried my best to explain what I learned from that. But
I just want to interject with a quick explainer for listeners. So what Joel's referring to is if there's 6 or 7 pieces or fewer, every position is solved. You can just put it into a computer and it will tell you, is this position a win or not? And 7, he's saying, well, the rest I think is self-explanatory, but 7 may not be like publicly available, but
yeah,
6 is.
I don't know about that, but I'm pretty sure that 7 piece now exists. But, you know, like the worst type of ending is one that, let's say, has 8 pieces on the board. And remember, the kings count as pieces, right? So if it's 8 pieces on the board, table base doesn't help unless you reach a position where there's some more trading. But the engines are often very poor in analyzing that. Now, of course, there was this particular type of animal called cess, which I had never heard of cess before. But apparently, cess is some guy out there that's running the Stockfish program on a very, very powerful computer. Am I right about that?
Yep, that's right.
And cess was, it's not that Svidler and Grishik were using cess. It's that everybody yeah. watching was, and they're saying, like, cess says 2.5 for white. But, you know, it's almost like an alpha zero evaluation. It's like, it's like telling somebody what's going to happen in 20 years. You know, it's like, how do you get there? You know, it's not useful to know the end result if you don't really know how to get there. And so it's a kind of truth, you might say, but it's not necessarily useful in terms of playing the game, because it's based on analysis that's so deep that nobody is actually finding it. Even the commentators aren't getting that deep, you know, when they can move pieces around on a board.
Yeah, and it was funny. Cess would have like 25,000 viewers all suddenly able to, you know, pontificate with super GM level analysis. And I did, I had a suspicion that this was true, but I just wanted to double check. And Lee Chess does now have a 7-piece table base available for free, just for the record. But
okay, that's great. So that will be for use in future liquidations. I'm confessing that I did not check any pieces in 7, any position with 7 pieces on a table base. Although I don't know if that was a big factor in any of the positions, but I will be looking for that in the future.
Yeah, probably doesn't change the overall value of the book too much, I'm guessing.
But also, I don't know like what kind of effect that has on your computer, or what, you know, whether you have to have a. I mean, I wouldn't want to download anything, because that would just you know, probably freeze your computer, bring your computer to a virtual standstill to have,
right?
You know, so it has to be something that you can easily just use. You know, this from a website.
Yeah. So Joel, just a couple more topics, if you don't mind.
Not at all.
Oh, excellent. This has been quite a treat. I really appreciate it. So number one, I'm sure you've asked this many times, but what are your favorite chess books?
Ah, okay. Well, you know, when I was a kid, I read a lot of chess books, and I have, I guess, a fairly big library, but, you know, the great majority of the books came, you know, when I was 10, 11, 12 years old. And, you know, it's quite understandable, because I was born in 1964. So we just had books. We did.
Right.
We didn't have computers. We didn't have the internet. We didn't have any other way to learn but books. So books were very, very important then. So I had a lot of them, and I read a lot of the old books. And I confess that I read far fewer books now, although I am a big fan of reading books. I think that people need to read more books, you know, if they want to improve, and I'm not really expecting to improve at this point, but if they want to improve, they should read more books. But there were some books from the old days that were very, very influential to me. One of them was called How to Open a Chess Game, and it was a book where chapters were contributed from several prominent grandmasters of the day. So like there was one from Bent Larsen, Larry Evans, Tigran Petrosian, Carey's also. So this is written in the mid-70s, I guess. I just thought it was fascinating because it wasn't just like, okay, here's some opening lines to memorize. It's like really how to approach the opening. And one of the grandmasters told a story about how he read some analysis which said, you know, okay, you play queen b4, and if knight c6, you boldly take the pawn on b7. And he says, okay, I played into the position, and the guy just defended his b7 pawn, and then he brought out his knight and chased my queen around. But the book didn't say anything about that, you know? So it's like the perils of leaning on things you read without analyzing them for yourself. So I thought that was really a tremendous book. That was one of my favorites. Neil Horne, I think, also had a chapter.
Yeah, I piqued my curiosity because I hadn't heard of it, and it's still on Amazon. Gligorich also had a chapter.
Gligorich, yes. I got to play Gligorich many years later. I mean, I got to play, I guess, a lot of the guys in the book. It's a great treat. So that was one of my early favorites. Another book that was tremendously influential to me, and this is from a chess author who is in the U.S. Hall of Fame for his writing, and he's written a lot of books, but when he really writes on serious topics, they're the best ones. This is Andy Soltis wrote a book called Pawn Structure Chess.
Yes, yeah.
And this book was awesome, and it was groundbreaking. Now, I think people since have tried to write similar books, and maybe they've done a good job. I think in general the book writing standard of writing is better now than it used to be, but the idea was the book was written on along the lines of chess structures. So it's like a King's Indian structure and a French defense structure and a Caro-Kann structure, and so you learned about how to use pawn breaks and how to you know, maneuver pieces and what to trade and all that stuff. So it's, you know, giving a lot of really important strategy that, you know, I think a lot of people don't ever learn. So that was tremendously influential. So I think those were the two books that I learned from most. And I'm going to just point out one other book from my childhood that I loved. It was by I.A. Horowitz, and it was called Chess. I may not get the order right. Traps, Pitfalls and Swindles. I may have reversed the order there, but it was those three words. And it was really basically, you know, like a whole bunch of games and positions where, you know, one player had this tricky idea and the other player saw further. And sometimes the first player saw further still in the end. But it was sort of like, it was almost a little bit like elements of the book that I just wrote, you know, about this thinking, you know, about how to outthink your opponent. And I thought it was just a really wonderful book, and I enjoyed it tremendously.
Okay, those are great recommendations. And the Pawn Structure book by Andy Soltis, who we fairly recently had on the podcast, and I know you've played over the years. Yeah, that one has been recommended, but the other two are brand new. So,
And I can tell you that I also read all three books in dinosaur notation.
Oh, man, yeah.
Although I think I may have the Horowitz book, I may have that in algebraic notation now, I'm not sure. You know, I think they've, I hope they were reprinted in Outbreak. I know that the How to Open a Chess Game, I believe that was RHM Publishing back then. And the other ones, I don't know. But they were really great books. And there are more excellent books today. I think that the general level of writing is just so much more enlightened now, especially because we have so many more chess teachers and coaches and trainers that the people who write books are much more in tuned with presenting information in ways that people can understand them. you know, which was different from back then. A lot of the books that were written were just, oh, I know all this stuff, and now I'm going to present it to you to show how smart I am. And they weren't necessarily as accessible. I just think that a lot of authors do that these days. So I think there are a lot of useful books out there. There are also a lot of terrible books, of course. There's going to be more terrible books because now anybody can publish books.
Right, yeah.
So there's going to be a lot more terrible books as well. But I think the general level of professional writing is pretty high.
Yeah, I agree. All right, Joel, one more topic, if you don't mind. If there's, mm-hmm. I mean, I know you've played Kramnik, you've played Anand, you've played so many legends, and you tell so many stories. So if there are any other stories that come to mind that you feel like drinking stories, gambling stories, anything anything fun from all your travels and adventures over the years.
Yeah, well, I'm not a gambler. I did imbibe in the old days, certainly. In general, and as in having read American Grandmasters, you know that that basically almost all my stories involve John Fedorovich.
Yes.
So I've told him many times that he's got to write a book. You know, he's got to
come on the podcast too.
Oh yeah, yeah. he's got to write an autobiography, and it would be really awesome. I mean, he's just very lazy about writing. You know, I'd be happy to work with him on it. I mean, it would really be a great book. But anyway, you mentioned some of those other guys. I would just point to one moment in time when I was sort of on the cusp from going from, you know, somebody who was, you know, a good player, you know, like a top 40 player, to someone that, you know, had a chance to really make a big splash. It was from the PCA qualifier in Groningen in 1993. And I started off the tournament really fast. I got three early wins. I remember I beat Patrick Wolf in the first round. And then they had one or two draws in there, but I defeated Ilya Smirin and Yevgeny Bereyev. So I was really on a roll. And I was playing all these top players. And basically, plus three was sort of a leading score. And in the end, plus three, you know, for the listeners, that means winning three more games than you lose. Plus three was a qualifying score. And the qualifiers got to play in the PCA Candidates, which was held in Trump Plaza. You know, of course, at that time, I had no way of knowing that would be a building I would not want to be in. You know, things were totally different back then.
Before it was notorious.
You're right. So anyway, I played all these big names, and a lot of these guys were, you know, were sort of known, but still quite young. Like I played, Kramnik would have been like 17 years old, but he was still, you know, like world class. And I got to jump on him in the opening, you know, like what? And right. I had a great position, but then I took a draw because I was running low on time and I didn't really see what to do. I played Topalov, and I got a better position with black, but I couldn't really do anything, so that was a draw. I played Anand, and I went crazy trying to beat him. I don't know why, but I just thought, I'm going to checkmate Anand. And I had a probably winning attack, but it was very, very complicated, even with the computers, and he beat back my attack, and he won the game. He dropped me to plus two. And then I had all these games where I had all these winning positions against, you know, a lot of leading grandmasters of the day, like Predrag Nikolic and Sergei Tivyakov and Yaron Piket. I had winning positions all those games. Against Tivyakov at one point, the computer said plus four. And I drew all these games. I stayed at plus two. And then I lost to Roman Ishin in the last round. Probably got the easiest pairing of all of them. So, you know, I was right up there with all these, you know, top guys who were trying to get into the candidates and didn't quite make it in the end. But, you know, it was like I was one of them at that time. So that was, you know, kind of a great experience to be there.
Yeah, I mean, incredible showing. And I'm sure I guess you have enough perspective now where it's probably recall it more fondly than like, you know, fixating on the near miss of qualifying.
It hurt, you know, it hurt, but I was still proud of what I was able to achieve. And I don't know, for you know, for fans out there, like for young fans who you know weren't around for the old days and you know don't really know how to look at the old players, you have to understand the ratings today are so much higher now than they used to be. Like my peak, the peak rating I had for my career is 2620, but 2620 was really maybe like 2700 today. You know, it was, you know, I say world class, you know, I mean, it wasn't top 10, but it was, you know, it was up there. You know, like, I beat Peter Svidler in 1997. He was 2660, which is not particularly high rating for today, but he, you know, he was one of the best players in the world, like he is today.
Yeah.
I don't even know if he's stronger now than he is today, but he's 100 points higher because right. all the ratings are higher.
I had him on the show and he himself said rating inflation is a real thing.
Oh, it's, yeah. And I'm not saying that these guys are not strong. It's just,
right, of course.
It's just
yeah.
that the ratings are just higher. And also you have to take into perspective that all these kids are going to become grandmasters at younger ages than people did in the past. Because for me, it was not really possible to become a grandmaster at 15 or 16. And I'm not saying that I necessarily had that level. Although I would say that I start to date myself as grandmaster level probably, you know, by, you know, definitely 18 or 19. I would say I was a pretty strong grandmaster because I was making, in 1983, I finished fourth in the U.S. Championship. So I was certainly a grandmaster level player. But I still wasn't a grandmaster until 1986 because it's very hard to make a 2600 performance when there were almost no 2600 players in the world. And one thing a lot of people don't understand is that the grandmaster norm was meant to be a world-class performance. It was set at a level where there's almost nobody in the world that had that rating, 2600. And it's still at 2600, even though 2600 is now a run-of-the-mill grandmaster. So, you know, almost any talented player that plays, you know, in frequent competitions is going to hit that norm just because the players are so high that very often you don't even need a plus score to make a grandmaster norm. You know, for me, like, I made a grandmaster norm, my first grandmaster norm in 1985 U.S. Championship. A rule change made it possible to make a norm in a national championship, and I needed every bit of plus five to get that norm, which I did by beating Walter Brown in the last round. So times were different.
Yeah, and being American-born was a serious hindrance back then as well.
Why do you say that?
Well, mainly in terms of chasing the norms. I mean,
yeah, that's true. That's true. But on the other hand, a lot of tournaments were formed for the purpose of making norms. Like Goitschberg, this is the heyday of Goitschberg's norm tournaments, and Eric Schiller ran a lot of them. I made my first IM norm in a Goitschberg tournament. Sorry, I made one IM norm in Goitschberg tournament, two IM norms in Schiller tournaments. Like in those Goitschberg tournaments, I used to play in a lot of those with Greg Shahadi's dad back then, mm-hmm. in those days. And a lot of players got titles. Interesting thing about that, when is it better to be a chess player? A lot of people say, well, you know, today you've got all these tools for becoming great, and everybody makes faster progress. But the problem is that everybody makes faster progress. So you've got so much competition out there that, you know, like for guys like, you know, Sam Shanklin, Ray Robson, they're great players, but it's really hard for them to climb to the top, right?
Yeah.
And for me, you know, when I hit 2,500, I was in the top 100 in the world. And this was a time when, you know, most of the Russian players were stuck in the gulag. They couldn't travel. Mm-hmm. And there were no chess players from China or India or basically anywhere in India, you know? Like all the best players all the people you compete against in these tournaments were Western Europeans. And there weren't nearly as many grandmasters, even from those countries. So, you know, when I was 23, I could go to, you know, an open tournament in Switzerland and command an appearance fee. you know, now it's hard for me to go to a tournament where they'll even, you know, give me a hotel room because there's just so many guys out there. So I'm going to say I'm not complaining about the era that I played in because I didn't have these advantages that people had today where they could maximize their game. But the competition was easier to rise up in the competition then. So I got to be top 40. So I have opportunities for more. So I have no complaints about that.
Yeah, well, I think me and, you know, basically everyone listening would have no complaints about having had your career either. So, Joel, thank you so much. This has been amazing. I enjoyed so much hearing your perspective. And in the description of the show, I will put links to the games you mentioned and, of course, to your three most recent books. I don't know if you want me to include Unorthodox Openings.
I don't even know if it's in print anymore.
I don't know either.
There was a 20-year gap between the first and the second book.
Yeah.
But I will write more of them. You know,
I will
keep writing. I'm going to try to write a book every year.
Good. Yeah. And I definitely recommend them. And Joel, I don't know if you're taking students or if you're publicly available or reachable, but if any listeners are interested in reaching out, are you open to that or would you prefer not to be?
Yes, I do have room for students now. So I'm willing to take them on. Generally they're, you know, more advanced players, but,
and should they reach you through chess.com or what's your preferred method for being?
They could maybe contact me on Facebook.
Okay, yeah. That works.
Yeah.
So I will link to that. And I think that is a wrap, Joel. Thank you so much. This was awesome.
Okay, great. And I have to say also that a number of people told me that that your show is great and I should go on it. So. So you're getting the good pub too.
Good. Thanks to whoever they are. This has been a treat.
Okay, great.
All right. Take care, Joel.
Okay, bye.
Thanks to everyone who helps make Perpetual Chess possible. That includes my esteemed producer, Matthew Passy, Geert Vandervelt for supplying the intro music, and Chessable.com for their generous financial support. I also want to thank everyone who helps support the show in little ways. That can be telling a friend about the show, writing something positive about it on social media, or writing a glowing review on Apple Podcasts or another podcast platform. Apparently that stuff really matters. I also want to give special thanks to my PayPal and Patreon perpetual partners. As you guys know, I put a lot of time into this show, a lot of research, promotion, actual booking of interviews, doing the interviews. I love the work, but it wouldn't be possible without the generous financial support of the following people: Adam Ralph of ChessEngland.com, Adam Vrancourge, Adrian Gutierrez, Alex Pejas, Ali Morchetti, Brian Mullis. I am Carlos Perdomo of ChessAtlanta.com, Bill Moran, Chad Hilton, Chad Oliver, Chris Balcom, Chris Flanagan, Chris Wainscott, Christopher Chabrie, Christopher Wood. I am Christoph Zalecki, aka Chess Explained, Coach J's Chess Academy, Dan O'Hanlon, Daniel Ginsberg, Daniel Lucas, Daniel Naylor, Daniel Schaefer, Daniel Viney, David Cramley, Dwayne Edmonds, Ethan Smith, I am Alec Donnie Ariel, Frank Tortoris, Gary Andrews, Gary Lewis, Geert Vandervelt, I am Greg Shahadi, Harish Srinivasan, GM Jakob Agard of Quality Chess Publishing, James Benastia, Jason Woolum, Jeff Anderson, Jennifer Valens of OffTheRook.com, Jeffrey Martello, John Fernandez, John Hartman, John Jernigan, Jen Shahadi, Jens Green, Jerry Wells, John Thompson, WGM Katerina Nemsova, Kelly Palmer, I am Kostya Kovutsky, Krishna Kabbalakrishnan, Laura Belyovsky, Leo Delgado, Lorraine Dore, Lucia Silva, Matthew Passy, Macaulay Peterson, Martin Habish, Matthew Tedesco of SeattleChessMeetup.org, my main man Moonmaster 9000, Nate Solin, Nathan Webster, GM Pascal Charbonneau, Passy Passanen, Paul Sweeney, Paulo Santana, Peter Lux, Peter Merrifield, Randy Temple, Ricky Grijalva, Rob Lazorchek of DiplomatChess.com, Robert Steiner, Ryan Berg, Ryan Sohn, Steiner Lima, Stuart Katz, WGM Tatya Vabrahamian, Thomas Stonix, Thomas Tachenko, Tim Brennan of TacticsTime.com, Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, Todd Bryant, Tony Rotella, Tyron Price, Victor Vrankulj, FM Zhao Cheng of Chess1000.com, and Jivko Stoyanov. Thanks, as always, everyone. I will catch you guys soon.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.